Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday morning. It's August 11th. Let's see, what have we got currently here in Old Town Park City? 67 degrees with some of those clouds breaking up. 68 degrees in the Heber Valley under partly cloudy skies. And on the phone, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at partly cloudy skies as we go throughout today. There will be a chance of some isolated showers and storms firing up this afternoon, about a 30 to 40% chance. Temperatures will be into the mid to upper 80s for highs in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the lower 90s in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Wednesday, Hump Day will feature a good chance of scattered showers and storms across the Park City area and most of the mountains in the Wasatch Back. Meanwhile, in the Heber Valley, we'll have a decent chance of a few of those isolated showers and storms developing in the afternoon as well. Because of the extra moisture, high temperatures will be held down to about 80 degrees. In Park City, we'll see those highs climbing only into the mid to upper 80s in the Heber Valley. But it gets cooler as we get towards the second half of the work week. Your Thursday will feature thunderstorms that will be likely throughout the day off and on. And that means temperatures will remain much cooler with highs only in the mid-70s in Park City for Thursday. We'll see those high temperatures only around 80 in the Heber Valley, so well below average with wetter conditions expected. That will continue into your Friday with a good chance of those showers and thunderstorms off and on throughout the day. Temperatures for highs will only be in the mid-70s once again in Park City. Will be around 80 degrees for your high temperature in the Heber Valley. As we move into the weekend, we will start to see some drier conditions beginning to build in. I still think there will be a decent chance of some isolated showers and storms on your Saturday afternoon with high temperatures in the mid-70s in Park City. We'll have those high temperatures in the lower 80s in the Heber Valley. By Sunday, though, I've just got us at partly cloudy skies, temperatures in the upper 70s in Park City. The Heber Valley will be in the low to mid-80s, so Sunday is your pick day of the weekend and really the best day, I think, here out of the next 7 days across the Wasatch Back. As we move into Monday of next week, we do start to bump those temperatures up just a tad. We'll be back near 80 for a high temperature in Park City with highs in the mid-80s in the Heber Valley, and again, looking mainly dry. That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Shane Scott, along with Communications Director Derek Sitterway, with the latest on the Rocky Canyon fire and the agenda for Wednesday's County Council meeting. Kelly Pfaff and Tom Seitz with Place Park City with an update on the petition numbers prior to Wednesday's Park City Planning Commission meeting and the issue being taken up on the Bonanza 5 acres at the City Council meeting on Thursday as well. And Dr. Nancy Romanzi with the V Foundation with details of next week's fundraiser for cancer research. Well, the Summit County Council meets in work session Wednesday starting at 3:30, and county staff continue to monitor the Rocky Canyon fire. In the studio with a preview of the meeting as well as an update on the fire, I have Summit County Manager Shane Scott along with Derek Sitterway, who's Summit County's Communications and Public Engagement Director. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Morning.
Derek, let's start with you. We know that the Rocky Canyon fires of 9 a.m. has burned just over 13,600 acres and is at 0% containment. We heard it was human caused. Do we know any more than that?
No more information on that. It's still under investigation at this time.
Okay. Do we know where it started? Was it near a road?
Based on the maps, I believe it was started in Morgan County, and it was relatively near the road, but I don't have an exact location, and again, and the cause is still under investigation.
Is that road just north of East Canyon Reservoir, around there, around
yeah,
that area?
Yeah, it was north of East Canyon Dam, so as you're heading down into Morgan on that side. Yeah.
Okay, 66 or 65?
I think it's 65. 66.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about the county's communication system. And I know there's been a lot said about the alert that people got on their cell phone, but we've had several, it seems like, misfires here. On Saturday night, about 9 p.m., it came across KPCW, the emergency broadcast alert, you know, alerting people to get ready. Again, that's something we have no control over because it just takes over the airwaves, basically. Mm-hmm. Then on Sunday afternoon, everyone's phone, cell phone from here to Wyoming to Salt Lake, I think across the state even, started going off with what's called a wireless emergency alert. That specifically said, quote, my residence is in the go evacuation area, which again just lit people up. And then on Monday, people in Oakley got a cell phone notification to evacuate immediately from the National Weather Service. So maybe you can explain what each of the messages is and who's responsible for sending them.
Derek, maybe you could hit the three. I would like to address the second one because that is in our purview, and I can do that. But maybe you could tell us a little bit about the first and the third.
And yeah, we're aware of those. Those are alerts that will be as we conclude, as the fire concludes, and hopefully we are able to take some time after, and we'll do an after action report. We're going to be looking at all of these instances to understand kind of what the cause was and what was going on. As Shane mentioned, there's a lot we can say about the alert that happened on Sunday. There's still information we're getting on the other two alerts, but the entire situation is something we'll address in an after action to understand what are things that we can do on our end, but also what are things that are going on with the system or with the technology that maybe need to be addressed with a different agency.
Yeah, okay, because again, nobody has really control. I think it comes either out of KSL or PBS. I mean, it's a state-run emergency alert system, the EAS, as we know it here at KPCW, again, that just takes over the board and sends out the alert. We see that, of course, on television as well, right?
Yeah. Where it just interrupts your programming and makes a pretty annoying noise.
So that was the Saturday night one, I believe. Okay, then let's talk a little about Sunday, because I think that for many people, that was the most troubling. Of course, the phone lines here at KPCW start lighting up. I started receiving personal phone calls and text messages. What happened? So this is actually the alert that the sheriff's office is responsible for sending out, known as a WES. Is that a WEA?
We call that the Integrated Public Alert Warning System. I think that's where the PAWS comes from.
So IPAWS is the alert that we send.
And I appreciate you bringing this up and for your coverage about this since Sunday. Initially, what went above and beyond who it was intended for, we initially assumed that someone had hit the wrong button. As we looked into it, we reviewed what was actually brought up and sent, and it looked like it should have only gone to 107 people. And so once we saw that and realized it went to thousands, just like you, I received everybody I know that lives in this community texted me and said, do I need to leave? It was a real mess, including leadership in Park City Municipal. The really confusing part to us right now, and we have a lot to do on this. We're all hands on deck managing the incident. We're not really able to investigate this the way we need to, but we will. And that's, I guess, what I would leave to your listener is that our commitment to finding out what happened and reporting back. Because, you know, we shouldn't even have the ability to, our emergency managers do not have the ability to message outside of Summit County. And this did go to Wyoming, it did go to Morgan County, it did go to Wasatch County. That shouldn't even be possible. So we're actually quite confused about what happened right now. What we're really mostly concerned about is we don't want to confuse everybody. So when everybody asked, why don't you just send a response, we couldn't trust it at that moment. We didn't dare tell someone not to evacuate that actually did need to evacuate. So out of an abundance of caution, we decided not to send out another alert through the same system. We asked Park City Municipal. Derek reached out to communications with Park City Municipal. We used every other available source that we could trust to tell people that they were not needing to evacuate if they weren't. So I just really want to sincerely apologize for that. That was, I'm sure, terrifying to many people. I received it myself, but of course I was helping manage the fire, so I knew that wasn't real. But there are hundreds, if not maybe even thousands, that did receive it that were very concerned, and I'm really sorry about that. What we mostly do not want to be is the boy who cried wolf. We don't want people to be able to trust these systems. That's, if I could just implore everyone, I know it's easy for me to say now, and you may not be as trusting of our organization right now as we want you to be, but if you get an alert, please follow that alert, even under this circumstance, and we're going to do better, and that's I guess that's our commitment.
Yeah. So I know you haven't done the investigation that you need to, but it sounds like it may be more of a software glitch if what you're seeing on your dashboard is only 107 people receiving the message.
That's exactly what we're thinking, and again, we just have not engaged with the software company yet. I don't even want to use their name on the air because right now I'm a little bit hot about it, and I just don't know exactly who to be mad at yet.
Yeah. In terms of training, I mean, I don't know how much you can train for this without actually, right, doing it, but I mean, what kind of training is involved?
So our county emergency manager sends out test alerts every month, and I'm one of the recipients of those test alerts along with other members of the sheriff's office and dispatch. So it is something that we do test and we do run through on a regular basis. And maybe one other thing to add to what Shane said is, in addition to where the alert was sent, the alert that was sent that just said evacuate now and that you quoted earlier, that was not the message that we had prepared to send out. One of the staples or foundational things we talk about in emergency alerting is giving specific locations on who needs to evacuate and also tying that to the incident and why they need to evacuate. And as we reviewed this, after the alert went out and looked at the message that was prepared that should have been sent through this, that was not the message that was sent out. So not only are we concerned on the area that received the message, but also the language in the message, what we had prepared was much more detailed than what went out. And we realized that that was a big part of the problem as well. So there's kind of two separate failures that we're looking into there.
Yeah, is AI an issue in all of this, do we know?
My understanding is there was no AI involved with this process, either with people preparing the message or with the software and technology that we use.
So tell us how the system should have worked. I mean, it's like you look at the message, you get some approval to send that message out. You can see where the message mm-hmm. will go.
That's right. You can see the geography of it. It will actually, as you draw that line of geography, it will actually tell you how many people that message should reach. And then, of course, it says exactly what the message should say. And then a human does hit the send button, but it's under those circumstances when you've already approved it. And most of the time, we have more than one person look at the message. That's not always able to be the case. We do a lot of our work remotely these days with managing incidents from other locations, but that's usually how that works. And so I guess that's what the real confusing part about this.
Okay, and after the Parley's Canyon fire in 2021, we learned a lot of lessons, like the messaging wasn't available in Spanish. So did that happen this time? Did that message go out to Spanish speakers as well?
Our understanding is that the message went out to everyone as it was received, which again, there are numerous issues there, not only with the location and not only with the content of the message, which in addition to what the message said, the multilingual issue with that message. I will say that's something that we're aware of from the Parley's Canyon fire and that we're going to be reviewing as part of the after action is, We hope and we're looking into this to do everything we can on our end to ensure this doesn't happen again, but also understanding if this were to happen again, how can we address it with the tools we have, not only to reach everyone we need to reach, but also to reach them in their preferred or main language.
All right. And then again, do you suspect any kind of scam within the system?
No, I don't believe so at this time. Again, this is something that we're investigating and is going to be ongoing after this incident. But with the information we have right now, based on the review we've done, again, we don't think that this was caused by AI. Again, AI, as far as my awareness is was not involved at any part in this process. And we also don't believe that this was a hacking incident or anything like that.
Okay.
One thing I was been really grateful for is the multiple ways that we can communicate. We have, in 2026, so many other ways in which, whether it's social media, when this one failed, I think it was kind of again, extremely unfortunate and needs to be different. But it was also a really nice exercise for us in, now what? We've abandoned that technology. What do we do now? And I think through our socials and through our partners with other organizations, we were able to get the word out as best we could.
Right, and it's a good example, as Shane said, of the redundancies we have with our communications, whether that's emergency communication or just different platforms. So in addition to social, in addition to reaching out to the dispatch centers and emergency managers across the state, we were able to use our non-emergency texting alerting system to send messages out to basically everyone in our system that said, hey, you can disregard this. And that reached somewhere between 10 to 12,000 of our residents that were signed up for either like our SC Fire text line or our General Summit County text line. And we also have a database of individuals that we can reach similarly based on their geography that we can just send to everyone too. So we used every available asset we had to make sure we got that message out as well as we could, which wasn't just social media or reaching out to the media, but also sending as many texts as we could and emails as we could to residents.
Yeah, so if somebody signs up for just like the fire messages, will they only receive fire messages or are they part of everything?
No, so the way our non-emergency alert text system is set up is it's set up through those keywords. So we have a General Summit County line, we have a roads line, we have a help line, we have a fire line. Those are all based on those topics. We also, as part of this system, have a database of residents that we've discussed this before, but had their cell phones registered through the post office, so we acquired those. And that list that's based on, that we can draw polygons and do things with, that one we're much more careful when we send things with. Again, it's not for emergency alerts, but I think this was a great example of a time when we would want to reach out to people and send that to them when we have a message that is very important and imminent, but is not an emergency alert.
Yeah. Any idea how many county residents have signed up for these fire alerts? And do we need to do a better job of, you know, getting those others signed up?
Yeah, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but as always, this is a good reminder. It's, you know, we never want to say that this is an opportunity because there are residents in Hennifer and other areas that are being impacted and this is very real for them. But for other areas of the county, this is a great opportunity to review where you're getting your information from, to sign up for SC Fire, to text SC Fire to 91896, to go on to summitcounty.info/fire and to review all of the places you can sign up for information. But also just to be prepared, you know, in the mountain community that we live in across the county, it's never a bad idea to be thinking about, even if I don't have a go bag ready at this moment, what are things that I would prepare? You know, take the opportunity to make a list of the belongings you'd like to gather, those important documents, the personal items that are important to you. Be thinking about places that you would go stay. You know, one thing we've seen in this incident is that we have an incredible community that's willing to bring people in when they've been displaced from their homes. As far as I'm aware, we have no one or very little people that have been staying overnight in any of the shelters. So it's a good opportunity to, you know, be running through those things. Who would I go stay with? Where would I go? What would I do? If I have animals of various sizes, how will I care for them and take for them? So again, always important, if you haven't yet, visit summitcounty.info/fire and see all the ways that you can sign up for alerts there, both just to be aware of fires and also emergency alerts, but also be thinking and planning on what you would do if this happened to you, because it's something that we're all aware of, but I think no matter how prepared we are, it can always be a little bit of a shock when it actually happens, so it's good to be prepared.
Yeah, and is there some progression in terms of what people would receive, though, in those emergency alerts, or are those saved for the go? People should have known to be ready and to be set.
So the majority of the county and other people in northern Utah aren't getting the other alerts because they are working as intended, but we have been sending other alerts out to residents that are these detailed, more detailed messages with information. So we're letting residents know when they're in ready status through our IPAWS system. We're letting residents know when they're in set status. And we've refined that language even since the incident on Sunday to be clear that this is what this means. This doesn't mean you need to evacuate now, but here's what you should be doing in this status. And we have sent additional go messages, again, that are more detailed than the error message that went out. Those have been going out to residents of Hennifer yesterday as well as the day before.
Okay, so get ready is just putting it in a bag.
Mm-hmm.
Set is putting the bag in the car.
Yes.
Yep. And then, in fact, I think I heard this morning on KPCW, it was someone from Heber that was explaining what those ready, set, and go statuses are, and I thought that was a very good description. I think the set was, you are prepared enough that you can leave in 15 minutes, and I thought that was a really good way to describe that.
All right. Let's see. Any other lessons from this?
I think the important thing for residents to know, again, is that we're looking into this, but also to remember to look to official channels for information. For example, on my phone, I have a weather app, and it was sending me information about the fire. When I went to look at the map, it showed the fire boundaries in a much greater and different area than they actually are. There are a lot of great apps out there and sources of information that are doing their best to be helpful, but don't always get the information most accurately. So when we do have an incident in Summit County, as an example, the sources you should look for are the Summit County Sheriff's Office social media, Summit County social media, and then going to the Summit County website. And that specific website, whenever there's an active emergency, is summitcounty.info/emergency. And we just encourage individuals to go there for information. We work very closely in this instance with the Type 3 team to make sure we're coordinating information and that we're getting their information and we're sharing it between us. But those are always the best sources to go to, aside from getting those alerts on your phone.
Okay. And KPCW, we do our best.
Of course.
And the local media, yes.
I just want to give this update because it's just come through with Utah Fire Info that we're still at that 13,600 acres. 23% is now under containment. So that's some good progress there. Do we know, is this private land or is this Forest Service land? Do we know that?
I believe at this time it's a combination, and I couldn't speak to what the breakdown is on what is on what, but I believe at this point with the size of the fire that we're on, a variety of different land ownership.
Yeah, and at this point, who's paying for it to fight it?
Well, that's a good question. We have a lot of personnel out there. It will obviously impact Summit County, or North Summit Fires is engaged. We've had teams come from Davis County and Weber County, and those organizations tend to fund their own personnel. We have the Type 3 team that you mentioned that also comes with their own. And we've talked about declaration of emergency, and that opens up funding from federal agencies as well. We haven't done that yet, but that may be something we need to do. And we're looking at the weather the rest of this week, and it looks relatively positive unless we get some lightning strikes that we're chasing down. But we're looking for some cooler temperatures and maybe even some rain. We're hoping that we'll make some relief. And I think we could really get our head around this incident the rest of this week. But we'll have to assess financially as well as part of our after-action reports.
All right. So do you have some kind of mobile command out at the fire area?
Yes. So we've been very closely integrated with the Summit County Sheriff's Office, who's taking the lead on evacuations and supporting them and also supporting the fire. So we have a joint information system set up that's been kind of moving around and mobile since this is such a dynamic incident. And again, also working very closely with the Type 3 team, which is a combination of state and federal resources.
And for people who don't want to leave, I mean, that's your choice?
Correct, yes.
Always. And we actually, besides initiating some evacuations in Hennifer, we did knock on some doors. That's not always the best thing to do, but we always get somebody that's unwilling to move and want to stay on their property, and we understand that, of course. But we'd encourage everybody in an evacuation status to please evacuate.
Okay. Let's see. I just wanted to ask you one thing about the meeting. Wednesday, Shane, at 6 o'clock, there is a joint meeting with Wasatch County. Yes. Is that happening in Colville?
It is happening in Colville. That's the plan. We did have Council of Governments meeting yesterday that was canceled because of this incident. We're hoping that we still have council on Wednesday in Colville. It's a relatively light meeting, but we do have a joint meeting with Wasatch County where we would like to talk about some regional transit, as well as I think Wasatch County is taking a formal position on preliminary municipalities, and we want to talk about that and what they're doing and see if Summit County would like to join them on that, which is, I think, relatively likely. So hoping the meeting takes place Wednesday, we're still hoping for the best.
Okay, and we've already made the decision on the Gun Club Road.
Yes.
Yep. Okay, Derek and Shane, thanks so much for your time.
Leslie, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Well, the Park City Planning Commission and the Park City Council both set to review the Bonanza 5 Acres project this week. The Planning Commission meets on Wednesday, the City Council on Thursday. In the studio with the latest from their efforts to see more park and less city on the property, I have Kelly Path, along with Tom Seitz with Place Park City. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For listeners who may not be familiar with this, I mean, can you just kind of briefly outline what is planned for that 5 acres and what specifically Place Park City objects to?
Please go right ahead.
Well, the current plan presented by Brinshore, the private developer from Chicago,
is showing, well, it's debatable. Some people say it's 11 buildings, some people say it's 7, but regardless, it's a circular of buildings consisting of 106 units of affordable housing. I think 88 of them are affordable. The rest are deed restricted. Some retail on the bottom, an area for arts, and some open space in the middle is basically the plan. Am I missing something, Tom? Arts and Council? I mean, arts and culture?
Yeah, the Arts and Culture District certainly is a big piece of it. So their proposal is an interesting one. It's significant because it incorporates some exceptions to building heights. It's a high-density development project between a private partnership and a public partnership. And so it has several elements of controversy around it. So that is kind of part A of the discussion. Part B is the Place PC group. And our approach has been an organic one, bringing citizens together informally, beginning in March, talking about it, visiting the property, talking about other possibilities, and then the result of those conversations became more of a formal PC, Place PC group that we're now talking about today. And our recommendation, our hope, is that based on the current proposal and the physical aspects of this, that we just take a pause. We stop and we ask the community the right questions regarding this important 5.5-acre parcel.
So, as we know, the 5 acres parcel has been the subject of planning and development discussions for nearly a decade. Mm-hmm. I guess, I mean, it's like, where were you on the first go around here? I mean, we have done this, like, this is the third time.
I can start that and Kelly can finish it. So I think the majority of the work around public, gathering public comments and input was in 23 or so. Things got pretty quiet right after that. And about that same time is when we started to see both Sundance and the Kimball organizations pull out. So there was a lot of conversations, a lot of discussion. Things got quiet. And then when something came to the surface, it was this proposal. And we were asked several times, both by council members as well as others, why didn't we come sooner? We didn't know what the proposal was. Once we saw physically what it looked like and what was being proposed and the way in which it was being funded, et cetera, we started asking questions about it. And we were reinforced, if you will, by the significant number of people that came to us and in the case of our petition drive, signed the petition in order to say, wait a second, we had no idea this was about to happen. And that's kind of where we are today. Kelly?
Yeah, we are learning. You know, what I'm learning as I've gone down the rabbit hole, I'm very involved I'm on the Prospector board because I have a business there. And I've gone to a lot of the feasibility meetings. I've been involved as much as I can. But what I'm learning in this process is it is really hard to be on top of everything. People have 8-to-5 jobs, you know, they get busy with their other stuff. And so now it's not surprising because we do get that question all the time, like, where were you? Well, we've been here. But, you know, if you're not paying attention all the time, it is easy to miss things. And we're just, I guess what has been reassuring for us is as we've been out there, people are like, what are you doing? What's happening at 5 acres? We're realizing actually a lot of people don't know about the project. And so it's been nice to be that information piece for them, showing what the city's been doing with it. So we've had a lot more support than we were even realizing we were going to get.
Yeah, I mean, we saw the exact same thing out at Dakota Pacific. It wasn't until like the vote where people started to show up. So you are gathering signatures on this petition. What exactly does the petition ask the city council to do?
I actually brought a copy of one of these. It says, you know, the city, we call on the city council to pursue a different vision on this site, a public park for park guides, a central gathering place for recreation, local arts, municipal use, and community enjoyment.
And what you've heard from City Council Member Tana Tolley is that this is exactly what we have.
Right. Yes, I have heard that from Tana. Well, again, it's city land that's being turned over to a private developer. So if you read through the website, I mean, it says we will make this private use available for the public 24/7. This just came out. So it's not, yes, it does have some components of this, but it also has some components that are exactly opposite of what the city was asking for.
All right, how many signatures have you collected?
We've collected a significant number of signatures that we'll be presenting to the city council on Thursday, but without getting into specifics, it's a couple thousand.
Okay, and are these Park City residents, or did you allow anybody in you know, Western Summit County to sign?
We most of our petitions were collected over the weekend at the market, although we had other locations. So being at the market, you know, we get a lot of 84060, obviously. But shockingly, of course, everybody in surrounding areas comes to spend money at the market, which is city dollars, right, city tax dollars. And so we decided that we would capture some of them as well, but majority is 84060. And even we were capturing people that came in from Salt Lake on some of our petitions because we realized these people are coming up here. We asked them, why are you here? Oh, we want to get outside. We want to see the mountains. And they're coming up and spending their money up here to enjoy the open space and greenery.
And Les, we should emphasize too that our decision to put a petition drive together, we agreed right away we needed wet signatures. We wanted to do the work, walk the neighborhoods, meet with people, tell them the story, and get their reaction. Not just send out an email sign our petition electronically and deliver it back to us. We think this has more substance and it delivers a different message and a sense of commitment from the community, not just from the eight of us that represent Place PC.
So the city has a significant need and a goal for building affordable housing. I guess, how do you balance your concerns about density with Park City's housing needs, especially in a location that's close to grocery stores, close to transit? I mean, it's where density should go.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think that's a very good point. And when I looked at the broader footprint of the area, the concentric circles, if you will, around this 5.5 acres, there's several already affordable housing facilities in place between the newest Engine House, of course, the HOPA property that the group that owns that would like to double that and add more housing there. We've got new stuff coming online that may not be sponsored by the city, but by the county between Studio Crossings, et cetera. So there's significant additional affordable housing that is being developed or is already in place. We fully support that. We know that a community is much more vibrant when it has an economy that supports all different socioeconomic citizens. But this is it's the right idea in the wrong place. It's almost that simple. The 106 units up that are being proposed, 80 of them or so are affordable housing units. And so that is a significant number, but not so significant that it couldn't be absorbed in another development.
So is there anything the developer could change in the proposal that would cause you to, or Place Park City to withdraw your opposition?
I think the challenge, and Kelly, forgive me if I'm jumping in too soon, but I think the challenge is, certainly as I've said already, we're not against affordable housing. We fully support it for the reasons I just articulated. But this proposal evades zoning, some of our own zoning rules regarding height restrictions, as an example. There is a trade-off between that and the quote-unquote open space, but the open space, the majority of it of which is hardscape. There is some green space, but it's not significant relative to the overall size. The proposal is gonna enrich a private developer off taxpayer dollars. That's a significant issue for us as well. We just don't think it's right. We've owned the land for a long period of time. This is probably what creates so much controversy around it, candidly, regardless of whether you support affordable housing or support open space or whatever happens in between those two extremes. So those are a couple of examples.
And I was going to mention, I mean, the property's been paid for not by residents, it's been paid for by people who stay here, right? Because it's coming off of the transient room tax. Mm-hmm. You know, they increased it by 1% to pay off this property. So it's not tax dollars, it's certainly tax dollars, but not paid for by locals.
Right.
Unless you stay here in a hotel.
Yes, that's how they purchased the land. But going forward, it's going to cost quite a bit of money to build the parking and the soil remediation and all these things that come in the future. So we do know eventually it's going to be hitting our pockets, and we just need to be very mindful of, you know, how we're spending our money over there.
All right, so have you been able to meet with any city planners, with a developer, I mean, to try and work something out?
I think, well, we all try to, our committee all tries to meet with different people of the city council. I've met with many. I met with the mayor last week. Just trying to open up the conversation of, you know, hey, can we sit down and look at a redesign on this project? Here's what we're hearing out on the street. So many people, you know, want to sign our petition, but they want to see, what would you do? They want to see a redesign, and we would love to put something together, but at the same time, it's not really our job to do that. So we try to keep the city council and the mayor informed of what's happening, and we appreciate everything that they're doing. We know sometimes it's hard when you go and you've invested this money so far, like with Brinshore, that it's hard to turn away and turn around and say, hey, let's, but I think our group and many of the citizens of this community are saying, it's okay to pause. We'll support you in that, because this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to do the right thing.
And perhaps what goes with that is that now that we do have this kind of groundswell of interest, understanding, and a broader appreciation for these different options, we would have a much more involved discussion and perhaps a better outcome than what happened during, you know, all the elements from COVID on forward, where a lot of this stuff was done, not for any clandestine reason, but just because of the way we've been living the last 4 or 5 years between that event and then this particular property, and then what we should do with it today to make it a real asset for the community.
And the argument, like I'm looking at here, you guys have a wonderful view from here. You know, that's a two-story building right there. You add 3, 4, now you're not seeing your mountain town. I mean, it doesn't take much to completely lose the views. And this is in the frontal protection zone, the FPC, Bonanza, Long Kearns. This is a very important corridor that's been protected by, I think, even the state of Utah to preserve those views as you're driving into Park City. So really, I mean, we're not against buildings on the property. We just don't want the 3 to 4 story buildings all in encompassing circle, private developer, where, you know, we have to ask for permission to come use the land, basically.
And what was the response from the mayor when you met with them? I mean, they're like, no, we have to finish the process here, or?
You know, it's funny. I mean, the mayor was very sweet, and I showed him some pictures and ideas. Up towards the end, it was hard to get a read on. It seems he's very focused on this particular design. He said he was climbing the Park City Mountain and showed me a picture looking down from the PC Hill. And he's like, see, Kelly, there's density everywhere down here. So it's not going to be a big deal to have density, which I guess I could see that argument. But my argument would be, we already have the density. Let's create a space for all these different retails and, you know, affordable housing that's already there to come and utilize something special. In fact, I was just at Good Earth yesterday. Somebody lives in the engine house. I asked him, oh, how's it going over there? He said, it's so nice. He's like, but I have nowhere to go outside, you know? And I was like, I can completely understand. And that's the other thing, is that holds at least 250 people. If we do this project, that's another 250 people. That's 500 people to that small parcel that is going to add so much traffic and congestion to an already, we know. I work in Prospector. It's a lot.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention? I think you're going to plan to be at both the Planning and Commission and City Council meetings?
Yeah, that's correct. We'll be attending this week both sessions, and then again towards the end of the month there'll be another 2 sessions with open forums for public comments. So we'll be there, obviously, to support those, to continue to introduce our point of view, and again to request a pause. It's almost that simple. Let's just stop and ask ourselves the right questions now that we've got an informed community to make the best decision for multi-generational asset.
Very well said. Yes.
Okay. Kelly Paff, Tom Seitz, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Les. Appreciate you.
The V Foundation, Victory Over Cancer, is hosting a fundraising event later this month to raise money for cancer research. In the studio with details, I have board member Dr. Nancy Romanzi. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so for those unfamiliar, just maybe share briefly what the V Foundation is and what your mission is.
Thank you again for having me this morning, Leslie. So the V Foundation was started by Jim Valvano, the infamous NC State basketball coach who won the national championship, was diagnosed with cancer 10 years later and died fairly quickly from his cancer diagnosis. We might remember him from his ESPY speech given in 1993, still one of the most iconic speeches of all time, where he talked about the development of the V Foundation in partnership with ESPN. Where he would, the intent is to fund researchers who are thinking out on the edges with novel ideas, so young researchers who are really pushing the envelope, so we could fund these great ideas that would lead to then greater funding and more investment in cancer research.
Okay, so talk about about how much money you have raised since the foundation was founded.
So in the 33 years, this past July, we've given out in cancer research $500 million. And that, interestingly, translates to an additional $22.5 billion in follow-on funding, which means basically that the research is legitimate and is being invested by other government and private agencies.
So how is the V Foundation then different, say, from like the American Cancer Society or like the Huntsman Cancer Foundation, a little bit local?
A great question. 100% of all of the money donated to the V Foundation goes directly to cancer research. We have no overhead because the foundation is completely endowed, and we can then give the money, we can turn it right around and give it to the researchers.
Okay, so talk a little bit more about your approach to cancer research, funding these unique and, you know, impactful.
Yeah, so we have a very organized and rigorous scientific evaluation process. In the 72 national cancer institutes that are in our country and in Canada, we can get applicants that think that they have a great idea. And then those applications will get reviewed within their individual cancer institute, then get forwarded to our scientific advisory committee that the V Foundation has, which is comprised of all of the leading scientists across our country. And they're graded very much like an NIH grant would be graded. So they're scored, and then those with the best scores are funded. The challenge, of course, always is we have more that have great scores than we can actually fund. So the idea would be to be able to fund all of them. And with that rigorous process, we identify the best of the best that go on to do great things with their research.
Talk about some of the great things that you've seen come out of the research grants.
I think that's a really good question. Many of us who watch TV, read magazines, and so on are familiar with the drug Keytruda. And Keytruda came from a V Foundation grant. The new and exciting drug that is now doubling the lifetime of patients with pancreatic cancer, a new pancreatic cancer drug, is a result of a V Foundation grant. So we're very excited about the ones that have certainly made it to the news, but there are others that obviously have contributed to the changes in the way that we take care of our cancer patients.
Okay. Let's talk about the upcoming fundraiser, when, where, and how much.
So on August 20th, we have a wonderful evening plan to raise money for the V Foundation. It will be at the U.S. Ski and Snowboard headquarters right here in Park City on Victory Lane, and begins at 6 with a cocktail party, and then we'll move on to a full program with food. And our program consists of our host, who is an ESPN, a former ESPN employee and cancer survivor himself, Elon Ben-Hanan. And then we will have as our featured speaker, Noah Elliott, our Paralympian and gold medal winner from Pyeongchang and the past Olympics in Milan and Livigno. And Noah is also a cancer survivor, so it would be wonderful to hear his story. We are featuring Melissa Reeves. Dr. Reeves is a recipient of a V grant, and she will be talking about her research. She is a powerful speaker, and her research is very compelling on what she is doing with immune therapy, looking at how a single tumor can have different responses to a single drug line. So she's investigating that so that she can figure out why tumors can then respond equally to the same drug regimen.
Mm-hmm. So any idea how many different grants are awarded each year? I mean, are they significant dollar-wise?
So the grants will vary. So when we're giving an introductory grant or a translational grant, like a translational grant is something that we can do at the V Foundation, which will go quickly from the lab to the bench side to patient side. And those individuals will receive $200,000 a year over 4 years. We also do follow-up grants, so called all-star grants, for those that are proving to do and have very compelling results that we want to give additional funding for. So the grants vary from $200,000 a year to a little more, sometimes a little less, depending upon where the individual is in their research protocols. We really stepped it up as a foundation when the government funding changed. And when government funding changed, we started to fund that gap for individuals to be able to get the larger grants from the government.
All right, so this is a national foundation. Do you do several of these fundraisers then in different areas?
We do. This is the a foray into Park City, so this is Park City's third year. We have signature foundations in Napa Valley, Chicago, New York, Phoenix, and Austin, Texas.
Okay. Let's see. Again, how can people join you?
So very easy. You can go to v.org, V as in Valvano, v.org/Park City, and you can see the link and sign up there. It's $175 per person, and it is a fantastic evening of education, entertainment. We'll have an auction lot and opportunity drawing at the end, with an opportunity to just give if you feel like giving. As a national foundation, we do have a lot, as you know, visitors to Park City that come and go, maybe have a second home here or something like that, and perhaps getting their cancer care in another location. So we fund around the country, and we fund all different kinds of research on all different types of cancer, so not isolated to one type of cancer.
Okay. And then, of course, we've got the IHC hospital with their new expansion, a cancer treatment center as
well. We do. That's very exciting for us. Absolutely.
Okay. Anything else you want to tell us?
No, just a reminder that 1 in 2 men, 1 in 3 women in their lifetime will hear that diagnosis of cancer. And I think, like Jim said, this is really important for us. Don't give up. Don't ever give up. And, you know, the cancer research may not save his life, as we learned, but it did save the life of somebody he loved. His daughter was diagnosed with cancer, breast cancer, when she was 33 years of age. Now the mom of 2 boys. So obviously cancer research did impact her life in a very positive way.
Okay. All right, Dr. Nancy Romanzi, thanks so much for your time this morning. Good luck with your fundraiser.
Thank you very much.
Taking a look at some local news now, Wasatch Back drivers will see daily and nightly lane closures this week as road work continues in Summit and Wasatch counties. On State Route 224, High Valley Transit is relining storm drain pipes through August 17th for its bus rapid transit project. Crews will be working on segments between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. between Canyons Resort Drive to Silver Springs Drive. Utah Department of Transportation spokesperson Kyler Sharp says crews will also be installing fiber optic cables along the way.
The really cool thing is this technology will continue or connect traffic signals along the route and support transit signal priority for the new BRT service, which is helping buses stay on schedule and improving overall reliability.
The High Valley Transit multi-year project will widen Route 224 to make space for dedicated bus lanes in an effort to reduce traffic. Sharp says Summit County drivers can also expect nightly lane closures from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. for repaving on Interstate 80 between East Canyon and Lambs Canyon. Lanes will close on westbound I-80 from 4 a.m. to 2 p.m. through Thursday. In Wasatch County, drivers will also see delays on U.S. 189 as UDOT adds additional lanes from Provo to Heber City. Sharp says this week crews will be paving new northbound lanes from Wallsburg to Charleston.
Flaggers will be north of Rainbow Bay to briefly stop or slow northbound traffic for trucks entering the highway, and it will last about a month.
And the Wallsburg to Charleston project will create new travel lanes on the eastern hillside as a separate elevated road. UDOT will also install a new traffic signal at the intersection of U.S. 189 and State Route 113, as well as adding new wildlife fencing. Project work will last until the fall of 2027.